From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump has been meeting with House and Senate leaders today to work out a deal to end the partial government shutdown that's now in its 13th day. The president is still adamant that he will veto any spending bill that doesn't include $5 billion for a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico. And Democrats insist they won't give him the money for the wall. Joining us now is NPR's Scott Detrow. Scott, welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay, what do you know about any progress toward ending the shutdown?
Well, a meeting began at 11:30 Eastern between President Trump and the so-called Big Eight, the top two congressional leaders from each caucus. And as of right now, that meeting is still going on. No one has emerged from the White House. So in terms of the absolute latest, I do not know anything, but I think I know this. Not many people, maybe they'll surprise us and come out and announce a grand deal, but very unlikely to make progress in this meeting. And here's why. It's what you said. Both sides are so dug in. It's hard to see any middle ground.
Well, let's look at what happened last night. The House passed two funding bills, one a short-term bill to fund the Department of Homeland Security for another month, another one to fund the rest of the federal government that's currently without funding through September. These would end the shutdown. Now, some House Republicans actually voted for these measures. So is this a bipartisan compromise we're looking for?
Not really in the current situation. You're right. Five and then seven House Republicans voted for these measures. And the bill is almost identical to what the Senate unanimously passed just a few weeks ago before the shutdown began. The thing that changed, though, is that President Trump insisted that he'd shifted course and insisted he wouldn't sign anything without the border wall money. And that brought almost every Republican along with him, saying that they wouldn't support that either. So Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that the Senate will not take up these two bills the House passed because he said he is not calling a vote on anything that President Trump wouldn't sign. And President Trump has issued a veto threat on those measures.
But there are some who disagree with that in his own party. Republican Senators Cory Gardner and Susan Collins say they want the shutdown to end. How much pressure can they and perhaps others eventually apply to Mitch McConnell?
Well, the thing to note about them is that they are both up for re-election next year in moderate Democrat-leaning states. So they're certainly among the first to feel the pressure. Right now, even though Democrats won so big in the House, Republicans gained a couple seats in the Senate. So it's not a situation where Mitch McConnell needs every single Republican vote like he did the last session. But that was an interesting early crack in the Republican facade. And one of the things we're looking closely for is do any other high-profile Republicans join those two?
There is talk that there may be a compromise that includes wall funding in exchange for protecting Dreamers, Dreamers being the immigrants who were brought here illegally when they were just young children. Any knowledge of any movement along those lines?
That's one of the things we're going to be asking about and listening for once this meeting breaks up. Right now, that hasn't really been a serious proposal. It's more so been something issued or suggested from people not involved in the direct negotiations. One of the things that Democrats have been frustrated by is the fact that President Trump keeps changing his mind. It keeps undercutting things put forward by other members of the White House, including Vice President Mike Pence. Democrats have said it makes no sense to negotiate with anyone but President Trump because he keeps undercutting people who work for him. So they're in the room with him right now. We'll see if that gets anywhere.
Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican senator, says that a deal with no funding for the wall would do damage to President Trump. On the other hand, I wonder who's likely to pay the political price if the shutdown drags on into a third week.
Yeah, one of the strangest dynamics of the shutdown, which is two full weeks now, is that you haven't seen either side, with the exceptions of a couple lawmakers, like we mentioned, Gardner and Collins, feeling like, oh my gosh, we're feeling the pressure here. We're feeling the effect of this shutdown. I do think the longer this goes, the more that changes, the more actual paydays are missed by federal workers and things like that. But so far, we haven't seen that many polling numbers, among other things, to get a sense of who voters are blaming for this, which is always, of course, the most important aspect of a government shutdown.
And who they blame on Election Day as well.
Yes, but the one thing that politicians involved in this have going for them is that at the moment, Election Day is very far away.
Scott Detrow, NPR congressional correspondent. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, the shutdown, not good news for farmers. At the U.S. Department of Agriculture, some farm loans are on hold, and aid to farmers hurt by the president's trade war with China is also on pause. Terry Dietrich is a cattle rancher and a grain farmer in Ames, Oklahoma. He's also president of American Farmers and Ranchers, Oklahoma Farmers Union. It's a group that advocates for farmers and provides insurance. Terry, welcome. It's a tough start to the year in Washington. How are things in your part of the world?
Well, there's an awfully lot of uncertainty, Peter, created by the combination of the federal government shutdown, and you couple that with the trade uncertainties, especially this time of year. It's time to be making plans for upcoming crops and calving seasons, et cetera, and there's just an awful lot of uncertainty. It's difficult to plan.
Sure. In Oklahoma, where you are, of course, has a lot of wheat, cotton, soybeans, cattle, hog farms. A lot of those farmers, as we mentioned, get loans from the federal government. What are you hearing about whether that money is flowing, and if it's not, how farmers are responding?
Well, and add to that the disasters that we've had, the massive wildfires and the storms that have resulted in having to get some loans to carry on. And yes, right now, you know, there's a lot of links in the chain between farmers in the country and USDA. And if one of those links is missing, the chain doesn't connect. And right now, there are a lot of links missing. And especially those depending upon some of these loan proceeds to carry on. You know, the cattle have got to be fed. The bills continue to build up. And when they can't access their money, it's not only going to affect farmers, ranchers, it's going to affect agribusiness. And the increased stress takes its toll on families and marriages right along the way.
Has it gotten to that point yet where people don't have the cash to pay their bills, or is that mostly something that people are still worried about in the future?
Well, it depends on when their need arose. For instance, the market deficiency payments, if they had all of their work completed by December 28, then some of those deficiency payments, because of the trade barriers, were printed. But if they waited until after the first of the year for tax purposes or whatever, they're out of luck until the government opens back up.
You mentioned the market deficiency payments. Those are the payments that the Trump administration is making to make up for the trade war with China. You mentioned that a lot of farmers are also planning ahead. Spring planting season is coming. I know the USDA issues reports every year with a lot of important data that can help farmers plan and better understand the market. What about those?
We are not able to access them. We have none of that information on which to make a decision on.
What does that mean? What kind of information don't you have then?
Well, it's very important that we know what's the carryover stock, and are we continuing our exports, or have they been shut down? That's another thing that makes all this really, really difficult, and it's just impossible to plan.
In other words, you don't know how much corn you might have left over from the season before, so you don't know how much to grow this year.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, the shutdown has no end in sight. Lawmakers from both parties are meeting at the White House today. It doesn't seem like they have a deal. As this goes on and on, potentially, how much harder does it get for farmers in Oklahoma?
Well, it will continue to get harder. I am chairman of the Oklahoma Agriculture Mediation Program Executive Council, and we have had more requests for mediation between debtors and creditors on the farm in the first 45 days of this fiscal year than we had all last year. Hmm. I think that's a pretty good indication that they're aware that there are problems looming. And, you know, as long as the balance sheet continues and doesn't exceed the amount of the loan, creditors are willing to kind of go along to a certain point. But back in the mid-80s, I lived through that terrible crash in the mid-80s. And it was wives, many times, that would go into the creditors, the banks, the farm credits, and say, please don't continue to extend the loans on our operating, because my husband's just going to keep going till we have nothing left.
Wow. So getting kind of scary there. Look, your state, Oklahoma, went for President Trump by 65% in the last presidential election. The Trump administration, as you say, also has put some pressure on people there because of his tariffs and the trade war with China. Who will farmers blame for this shutdown?
Well, Quite frankly, I think they're pointing a lot of fingers in Washington, D.C. at each other, and they have forgotten that every time they point a finger, three are pointing back at them. They've just got to get over the partisan politics, and they've got to sit down and compromise, and they've got to do it for the welfare of the people, not the welfare of their party.
That's Terry Dietrich. He's president of American Farmers and Ranchers, Oklahoma Farmers Union, and a cattle rancher and grain farmer himself. Terry, thanks very much for your time, and good luck to you.
Peter, thank you for the opportunity so much.
And let's take a closer look at two incidents this week involving captive wild animals. On Tuesday, a toddler in Florida was injured by a rhinoceros after slipping into its zoo exhibit. 2 days before that, a 22-year-old intern at the Conservator Center in North Carolina was killed by a lion during a routine cleaning of its enclosure. The lion was shot and killed by police. Kitty Block, CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, has been speaking out about this. Kitty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk first about what happened in North Carolina. The Conservators Center, where this intern was killed, is not an accredited zoo. Can you explain the difference between one of these animal centers and a zoo?
Sure. There are thousands of places, roadside zoos, private individuals who keep animals, wild animals, lions, tigers, you'd be shocked. And North Carolina is one of the four remaining holdouts that allow this, which is dangerous and it's inhumane for the animal.
And this young woman who was killed, she was in the animal's enclosure. She was cleaning it, but the animal was sort of off to the side in another area. Apparently that did not work to keep her safe. How could this have been prevented?
Well, as was mentioned in the police report and other things, this was not an accredited AZA zoo. It was USDA licensed, but USDA license, it's really the bare minimum. So there are so many additional protocols they could have followed and things they could have done, which need to be done. If you have wild animals, you have a responsibility to make sure that the people that come in contact with them are safe and that the animals are in good humane condition.
Now, on the other hand, in Melbourne, Florida, this was an accredited zoo, and this is where the toddler slipped through a barrier and was injured by a white rhino. It was a hands-on exhibit. So accreditation is not necessarily a guarantee of safety.
You're absolutely right. I mean, accreditation really is incredibly important. But in the case in Florida, it was a hands-on exhibit. And that's something that the Humane Society of the United States does not support. Wild animals should not come into contact with humans under any kind of setting.
Hmm. A lot of zoos would say that they're working to promote animal conservation. These types of exhibits allow access to animals that, frankly, not everyone could afford otherwise. You know, not everyone can just get on a plane and fly to Africa for a safari. I mean, isn't there some value in these efforts to put animals and people this close together?
Well, I think that's different than a hands-on petting experience. Letting people see animals when the animals are in a humane setting and that they're following the highest accreditation, that's something different. But to actually let children touch these animals, well, that's just asking for trouble. It is dangerous and it's incredibly stressful to these animals.
Hmm. The rhino encounter had been open since 2009, presumably without a high-profile incident like this. I mean, what should the relationship between humans and animals look like? I mean, how should we get close enough to them so that we can better understand them?
Well, you can view them and you can watch them, but it's hands off. And there should never, ever be private ownership of these animals, nor should these animals be in settings where they're not in places that are accredited and the highest possible standards. And so that's also why the Humane Society of the United States is working on federal legislation to actually get a framework that will get all states to take on these issues and really better the lives of these animals and have so much better safety for people involved.
And that law is called the Big Cat Public Safety Act, expected to be reintroduced in this brand new Congress. You also write that since 1990, 24 people have been killed by captive big cats in the United States. Kitty Block, CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Even with the strong jobs report that came out today, many Americans are concerned about the economy. Europeans have fears about their own economy. And right now, a lot of those worries are focused on Italy. Unemployment in Italy is ticking up above 10%. And among young people, it's 31%. That's one of the highest in all of Europe. Italians are voting with their feet and their suitcases. The number of people emigrating from Italy has doubled in the past few years. And as reporter Anna Benstead tells us, a majority of those leaving are young and skilled.
At a rooftop restaurant in Rome, a gathering of young academics and their friends is underway. The view is glorious, the pasta is perfect, and the local white wine deliciously light. But when the conversation turns to whether Italy is still a country for young people, the mood is far from lighthearted. 22-year-old Martina Cioffi says her plan to leave Italy, once she graduates from the prestigious Bocconi University, is now common.
So I think that people grow up knowing or thinking that they won't have the same opportunities in Italy as they would abroad. So we graduate thinking that, yeah, we will go somewhere else to find a job that suits our capabilities.
But do you think Italy is losing a lot in terms of innovation, in terms of skills?
Definitely. I mean, who can better innovate if not young people?
Hello. Ciao. This is a great spot.
Further north in Florence, I meet 28-year-old Elisa Lazzarini, who feels exceptionally lucky that after 5 years abroad in Brussels and London, she was able to find a job she loved here at home.
I have plenty of friends that are in their early 30s and decide to leave Italy and go to the other side of the world, for example, to Australia. A friend of mine just bought her ticket because she's like, I'm going to be a waitress forever here. Let's see if I can find something better in Australia, not even in the UK. And we have come to this extreme.
Allora, io sono Marco, sono a Firenze e sto parlando di mia figlia Leonora che lavora in Irlanda alla Apple.
Marco is a plumber in Tuscany. His daughter just moved to Ireland for a job at Apple. She earns enough there to live independently, something she could not do in Italy. Professor Enrico Pugliesi from Rome University, whose research is on Italian migration, says Marco's situation is typical.
Emigration is not present in the public discourse. Emigration is present in families. Wherever you meet in southern Italy, a middle-class lady, and this guy, oh, where is your daughter, Sarah? She's in Luxembourg.
Or the son is in London or in New York. Pugliese's 2018 book on the subject, Quelle che se ne vanno, Those Who Leave, analyses how Italy is once again a country of emigrants.
Now we have figures comparable with those of the age of the great post-war Italian emigration.
Across town in Rome, Irena Tinagli is a politician who's been trying to move the matter from the kitchen into public discourse. She says tackling a dysfunctional labour market that's heavily weighted against the young is a priority.
Our labour market is very rigid. Companies, especially the largest ones, until last year, 2 years ago, basically they couldn't fire employees, or at least they, you know, it was a very difficult process. So what would happen is that larger companies, they spend most of their human resources money on older workers and have just, you know, pocket change to hire younger and sometimes much more competent workers.
There are Italians, though, who see what's been called a brain drain as a sign of Italian strength.
I'm Paolo Fresco. I'm an Italian, an old Italian.
From his house perched on a hilltop above Florence, there is something eagle-like about Fresco's view, not just of the city, but of the state of Italy, a view backed up by a formidable career in the US as Jack Welch's right-hand man at GE and in Italy as chairman of the board of Fiat. Fresco has one word for those who complain about the brain drain.
Myopic.
He firmly believes that Italians and Italy are enriched by international experiences of emigration.
The fact that the Italians, the best Italians, have better opportunities than those being offered by this country, that's a great advantage. That's the advantage of globalization. The country doesn't offer enough, they go elsewhere. Globalization is good. because it allows people to broaden their mind.
Fresco acknowledges the problems causing young people to leave, but he still thinks they should go.
We have the most beautiful country in the world. We have art that nobody else has, that everybody envies us. So we are privileged. What we have to do is to try to make it also a place where a young person has an opportunity. It doesn't need to wait 30 years in order to be promoted in a position where you can really express his talents. But you don't resolve the problem by keeping people inside.
Meanwhile, in many Italian families, heated discussions continue as to whether it's the right decision for a young person to emigrate. At a gelateria in Fiesole, I meet Pablo, a taxi driver. Pablo swings into high verbal gear as he describes how Italy, a country of great culture, of the Renaissance, will not be a place where his son, Duccio, a talented classical musician, can stay and work. He'll have to go abroad.
Però intanto manderò mio figlio all'estero con tutte le mie risorse.
Duccio is calmer and seems wise beyond his 18 years.
In Italy you study a lot, you get good with your instrument, and then you have to find a job, but it's really hard because there are no real possibilities. If I am lucky, I will find a work maybe in Germany too, or my dream is in Australia, to find a work in Australia.
Such ambitions are far from comforting for Italy, a country that has the second oldest population in the world after Japan. For now, though, at least, Duccio is still in Italy, enjoying a gelato with his father and entertaining guests with his clarinet. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Benstead.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Just another wild day on Wall Street. At one point today, stocks surged more than 800 points after the Labor Department said the U.S. economy added 312,000 jobs in December. And on this news from Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, who spoke this morning in Atlanta about the Fed's interest rate policy.
We will be patient as we watch to see how the economy evolves. But we're always prepared to shift the stance of policy and to shift it significantly if necessary in order to promote our statutory goals of maximum employment and stable prices.
Okay, let's bring in Michael Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News. Mike, good to have you.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
Let's start with that jobs report. 312,000 non-farm jobs in December, the most in 10 months. That blew away expectations. What was behind that? Why is such a surprise?
It's interesting. You're absolutely right. It was about 128,000 more jobs than the economists that we survey had expected on average. And it was a big surprise. I especially when I first saw the number thought, well, maybe there was a lot of retail jobs added for the holiday season. But it's important to point out that it was a lot more than that. The healthcare sector, manufacturing, construction, and business and professional services all posted very strong gains for the month. So it just sort of shows that people had gotten maybe a little too pessimistic about the economy and the prospects. And this was definitely a pleasant surprise.
Yes, hourly wages rose 3.2% over last year. That's one of the biggest increases in the past decade. How do you square all of those numbers with the warning signs that we've seen the economy giving us lately?
Yeah, it's definitely some mixed messages. I mean, I think the overall theme on Wall Street is that overseas growth has slowed down. Overseas economies are weakening a little bit. And everyone expected that to sort of infect the U.S. economy. And there are various other data points that sort of back that up, that we're sort of coming off the boil of the economy after the stimulus from the tax cuts. But this jobs report today really sort of contradicts that narrative to some degree, and you know, gives people hope that, well, maybe the slowdown isn't going to be as bad as expected.
Now, there had been some concern that if there was a strong economy, that the Federal Reserve would either continue or pick up its pace of interest rates, which was causing a lot of the fluctuation on Wall Street lately. But we heard the words from Fed Chairman Jerome Powell this morning. He said that Fed will be patient if economic conditions call for it. The markets really liked that. But translate what it means. Is he essentially saying that the Fed may not raise rates as much as planned after all?
That's certainly the interpretation, you know, and I do think these comments were basically engineered for the purpose of stabilizing markets. So he's basically reiterating what he said all along, is that they will be data dependent, meaning if the economic data does weaken, if the job market weakens, and if inflation really doesn't sort of overshoot their goal, that they will be less aggressive with rate hikes. And the other thing is the unwinding of the balance sheet that the Fed built up during the quantitative easing program. A key point he made today is they might adjust that program so that they're not rolling off the assets that they purchased during the aftermath of the financial crisis as aggressively as they thought they would. And that's very a very much a positive sign to Wall Street that's been worried about that process.
Mike Regan, Bloomberg News. Thanks so much. Jade Rabbit 2 started exploring the far side of the moon today, a first for humankind. The Chinese lunar rover landed on the dark side of the moon yesterday in a mission that could lay the groundwork for a human-occupied lunar base. Since its first manned spaceflight in 2003, China has emerged as a leader in a sequel to the Cold War-era space race. Let's talk about that with Namrata Goswami, an expert on China's space program. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So is this mission to the dark side of the moon a symbol that says to the world that the Chinese space program has arrived?
It is, for two reasons. One, because this is the first landing on the far side of the moon that has been accomplished by human beings. It's a very, very symbolically and technologically significant development, and it shows to the world that China's space program has arrived and can do original feats on its own.
Long term, what does China want from the moon?
So China views the moon as a base that it can utilize for research, for deep space exploration, to include asteroid mining and looking at further into the solar system. And in their white papers, they have articulated their vision for looking at moon not just by itself, but as a stepping stone to further their goals for becoming the only species on Earth to establish a human presence on the moon.
Well, in fact, the Chinese have a plan to create a manned lunar base on the moon, which is incredibly ambitious and, of course, would be a first.
Yes, that's correct. In fact, if you look at what they have done on Earth last year in Beihang University in Beijing, they have generated a simulated lunar-like surface where they have had students live in that condition for about 365 days. Hmm. So yeah, so the long-term ambition is to see the view the moon as an industrial base that's going to enable China further on to explore deep space, to include asteroid mining.
So as you say, the moon is one thing. Another thing altogether, for frankly, the United States and China both, is Mars. What can you tell us about China's plans for that planet?
China has announced a program. So by 2035, building on their capacity for the moon, they're looking at sending a robotic probe to Mars. And also, very interestingly, two robotic probes to the poles of the moon. And so in terms of that program, I think what China is doing is very different from what NASA or the U.S. is focusing on. So as you know, today for the U.S. space community, including NASA, Mars is the significant concern. Hmm. How do you go to Mars? How do you ensure humans going to Mars? How to develop the technology? For China, they're having Mars, but that's the next term goal. The first is the moon. And I think that's a much more smarter strategy, because if you develop capacity to be on the moon, that gives you a very cost-effective ability to then go and explore Mars, which is also going to be much, much cheaper.
And I understand the Chinese also want to use that probe on Mars to collect soil samples and bring them back to Earth. How significant would that be?
That'll be significant because very similar to the lunar surface where they are planning to bring back soil in their next probe so that they can see how much resources are there. Similarly, a sample from Mars would then enable humanity to understand what's the composition of that soil, what kind of elements it consists of, are they volatile, do they include any trace of water. But, you know, it's interesting that I need to point out that for China, Mars is not the focus right now, it's the moon. And I think I understand their strategy because the moon seems to be the place where there is enough titanium. For instance, the rover has landed on the oldest crater of the South Pole. And so the important point is that this crater consists of three very important space resources. One is water. Two, there could be huge amounts of iron. And then there is thorium, which can be used for generating electricity from nuclear reactors. Mm. So I think their strategy is to look at Mars, but only in the next 20, 30 years. It's an incremental strategy to first establish capacity for a moon base.
Okay, so all of this clearly has the United States concerned. President Trump and others have characterized space exploration as a matter of national security. And here's the president announcing the creation of a space force in June.
My administration is reclaiming America's heritage as the world's greatest spacefaring nation. The essence of the American character is to explore new horizons and to tame new frontiers. But our destiny beyond the Earth is not only a matter of national identity, but a matter of national security, so important for our military.
How much is this competition from China driving this talk in the United States about a space force?
I think it's one of the fundamental reasons, because if you look at the debate that preceded the Space Force creation, you had Alabama Representative Mike Rogers, you have the representative from Tennessee, Jim Cooper, who argued that what China is doing in terms of ASAT technology, in terms of aligning its military to look at space as an area of focus since 2015, has resulted in American space assets being vulnerable. Hmm. And I say this with a measure of seriousness because if you look at the U.S. military, it's extremely dependent on space for GPS, for precision-guided missiles, for its nuclear submarines. So if China can hold those particular assets vulnerable based on the capacity it's building, that can create some kind of fear in terms of the U.S. military's ability to engage in the Asia-Pacific and the role it has in the world. And so I think the establishment of a space force that is able to bring together different agencies of the government into a single administrative unit is actually quite needed.
Well, and China has its own plans for a GPS system to create its own, which could be of concern to the U.S. government, as you mentioned. But is militarization an explicit part of what the Chinese are doing in space?
It is one of the components. For instance, if you look at the speeches given by President Xi to the Strategic Support Force, which was established in 2015, for which space is a subunit of focus, his argument is that this particular organization will develop innovative military warfighting capacity to ensure that China has dominance in terms of access. Mm-hmm. And so I think I bring you back to the most important debate here, and that is access to space, especially not space just as a functional body that gives support to Earth-based functions, but space as a geography. China is viewing space more as a geography, as a place where they can establish presence, especially for maintaining access and dominance. And so I think I find this exciting, but I also have reasons for concern. If you look at how China behaves when it establishes first presence, for instance, in the South China Sea or, for instance, in Tibet, I fear that if China establishes presence, that will lead to access that it would then claim as an entitlement, as it has done here on Earth. So I fear that if we do not have an international regulatory system in place, it could lead to China claiming first presence rights.
And there are people in the United States who would argue that NASA and the government have lost focus on space. I mean, NASA canceled its manned space program several years ago, as you know. The U.S. now relies on other countries to get astronauts to the International Space Station. I mean, you could make the argument that China is far more focused than the United States on this issue.
Yes, and to add to your point, I agree with you that in the last 20 years, the U.S. has lost focus, especially under the first two Bush administrations and to an extent under Obama. And as you know, under President Xi Jinping, space is one of the topmost priority of the Communist Party of China, and they have committed resources for the next 20 years. Unlike in the U.S., where you have a change of regime every 4 years or every 8 years. Also, you need congressional approval, which sometimes do not come forward. And so I think that's a clear advantage that China has in terms of space.
Now, I think we do need to give the United States some credit for what they're doing. On the same week that China lands this spacecraft on the dark side of the moon, NASA has its own victory. The New Horizons spacecraft is sending back pictures of the most distant world that has ever been visited by a man-made object. Is your feeling that this competition between the U.S. and between China is good for everyone on Earth, that it pushes us all to strive just a little bit harder?
I think the competition is good because, it encourages other nations to look at both countries' capability and capacity. And I come from India, which has also a very robust space program and has been able to send a rover to Mars, being the first Asian country to do so. So yeah, the competition is good in terms of the innovation that it's going to encourage. For instance, you know that the GPS system was also a part of that competition with the Soviet Union and came out of the military and DARPA. Mm-hmm. China's ambitions have been articulated very clearly, and that is to establish humanity's first base there for industrialization, for presence. And I think China has very successfully changed the discourse on space by articulating those ambitions very clearly.
That's Namrata Goswami, an expert on China's growing space program. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced its final plans last month to roll back guidelines for school lunch programs. The guidelines are part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. President Obama signed it into law in 2010 to ensure that kids are getting healthy food while they're at school. The changes will go into effect by July, and they apply to school meals that qualify for some federal reimbursement. They will loosen nutritional requirements on milk, whole grains, and sodium in nearly 99,000 schools across the country. Bettina Elias Siegel is author of the forthcoming book, Kid Food: The Challenge of Feeding Children in a Highly Processed World. Bettina, what's your take on these nutritional rollbacks?
Well, I think first and foremost, I would want people to understand that this rollback was entirely unnecessary. 99% of districts were already meeting the old and more stringent nutrition standards under the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. And specifically with respect to whole grains, which was one of the topics in question, 85% of districts were having no problem meeting that standard. And even for the districts that claimed to have a problem, there was already a system in place where they could seek a waiver. So this was really entirely unnecessary, and yet it does have very serious consequences. 30 million kids eat school meals every day. Two-thirds of those kids are low-income children for whom school nutrition is incredibly important. And so, you know, these changes have real consequences and they're negative consequences.
So there are a lot of different views on this. And we reached out to Gay Anderson, who is the president of the nonprofit School Nutrition Association, which represents school cafeteria workers and companies that supply food and equipment to districts. This is what she had to say about the whole grain issue. And it's not every school district that's having trouble using whole grains, but she said this is what happened in her experience.
We hear about the whole grain biscuit down south or the whole grain tortillas. For me, I make homemade chicken noodle soup in my district. It's a very favored thing. But the whole grain noodle, it didn't stand up. It would break down and we wouldn't have any noodles in our soup. And so I actually asked for a waiver through my state so I could buy a regular egg noodle and be able to use that for those days so we could still have a good product.
So despite the fact that it may come from a good motivation to have whole grains in school lunches, there are, in some cases, real problems with trying to implement that. What do you say?
Well, first of all, I'd like people to understand that when we say whole grain, we're not talking about 100% whole grain pasta or 100% whole grain bread. We're talking about whole grain rich, which means that these foods, pasta, hamburger rolls, simply have to contain half whole grains. So that's the first point. Second, it's really important to keep in mind that by law, the National School Lunch Program's nutrition standards are supposed to match the dietary guidelines for Americans. Those guidelines are unequivocal. Adults and children are supposed to be eating half whole grains in their grain foods. So this was merely consistent with dietary science. Manufacturers have had years now to both anticipate that these new standards were coming and then to adapt to them. And I have spoken to school nutrition directors around the country who have said it's a bit of a red herring to claim that the products on the market don't meet standards, because manufacturers have certainly had time to do so.
Here's another point. Even if they do meet those standards, there's the issue of whether or not the kids will eat the food. And Gay Anderson weighed in on this as well.
Some of it just has been a very large waste for our students, and they're throwing away the food. And we don't want them throwing away food. We want them eating and consuming the food.
So if kids really aren't that interested themselves in lunches with lower salt and more whole grains, doesn't that prove the point that there is more waste and you can have the regulations you want, but kids are turning up their noses?
Overall, participation in school meals has been increasing. There may have been a drop in participation among higher income kids, but that is likely attributable to the fact that school meal prices have gone up. But among kids who truly need these meals, the kids who are federally subsidized, the participation has dramatically increased in the last, I think, 10 years.
If you say that these moves in the rollback are unnecessary and gratuitous, and that most schools are meeting the guidelines as they existed, what do you think the motivation is for the rollback to begin with?
So if I'd like us to step back, you know, from this particular conversation about rollbacks and look at the bigger issue, which is why are we not funding this program adequately and providing districts with the support that they need to be able to serve healthier food to children?
How short is the funding?
Well, when the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act went into effect, districts were given an extra 6 cents per child per lunch to meet the healthier standards. And at the time that 6 cents was added to the budget, it was widely thought that districts really needed 10 cents per child per meal to meet the standards. So they are already like fighting this uphill battle. And again, I think that's something I would like more parents and Americans generally to think about. Why are we not funding this program adequately?
Bettina Elias Siegel is the author of the upcoming book, Kid Food, The Challenge of Feeding Children in a Highly Processed World. Thanks a lot, Bettina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.